it's a very sort of polite and gentle culture. So, for example, when you meet somebody for the first time, you say, Hajime Mashite. And naturally, one has to bow one's head when one says anything. So it's quite a soft-sounding language. So, for example, if I said to you, Hajime Mashite, Jennifer-san, dozo yoroshiku, it doesn't sound harsh in any way.
What are you telling me?
Just pleased to meet you, Jennifer. Well, best regards, I suppose you could say, for dozo yoroshiku. It hasn't really got a direct translation.
But there's a real joy about the softness of the language.
Yes, and it's quite an imprecise language. For example, there's no equivalent of the or a. So you have to know from the context. And because this imprecision of the language is a reflection, of course, of the culture, and because people try to be polite to each other, there is a word for no in Japanese, but people generally don't say no. So, you know, if you ask somebody a question and in English you just say no, the answer will be much more gentle and meandering, and you have to read the no between the lines. And that, I think, was lovely, to be learning the language and then to see how that reflected the culture, and then to encounter the culture, of course, when I first went there.
But it must have been very unusual for a girl from Cheshire in the early 70s to be learning Japanese.
When my father suggested to me that it would be a good idea to study Japanese, my teachers at school just said, we don't know anyone who's ever been to university to study Japanese. And when I started at university, I was having to start from scratch. There were only six of us in the group. In a total university intake that year, there was perhaps 25 of us in the whole country, so it was quite unusual.
But it's quite a dark reason that led you to study Japanese. It was at the urging of your father, and he had spent 3.5 years as a prisoner of war in Japan after being captured in 1942. He was just 16 when he joined the Navy.
Around the turn of the year, 1941-1942, he was on HMS Exeter, and the ship was sunk. He floated in the sea for quite a long time, 18 hours or something, was eventually picked up by a Japanese ship. So he became then a prisoner of war for the remainder of the Second World War.
Your father gave talks locally about his experience, and one of these talks was recorded. And we have just a little piece here where he's talking about the moment that his ship was hit.
It was just a mass of smoke, devastation, dreadful. Although I say I knew that we were on our way out, to go out there, see all these men rushing round, men badly injured, men lying dead, and the ship heeling over, almost about to go over. Quite a frightening experience.
I think quite a frightening experience must be something of an understatement.
He talked quite vividly about that experience.
Yes. It's something you would never forget, isn't it?
But he was in three different camps.
Yes, initially he was in Makassar, and apparently the treatment there was particularly harsh. And then he was moved to the Japanese mainland, to Nagasaki. He and other prisoners of war had to work at this place called Kawanami Kaisha, which was a shipyard. And it was there that he met a man called Mr. Sugimoto, Genzo Sugimoto. And for some reason, I don't know why, maybe it was because Dad was so young, Mr. Sugimoto took pity on Dad, and he risked his own life by bringing Dad small pieces of food to the workshop. So he'd try to bring Dad, you know, a sweet potato or a tangerine or something like that. Mr. Sugimoto seemed confident that Japan would not win the war. And he used to say to Dad, when the war's over and you go back to England, I want you to send me a pair of English boots. And so every day he made Dad repeat his address.
Did your father ever send the boots?
He didn't send the boots. No, I don't know why. I imagine when he first came home, there must have been quite a strong anti-Japanese feeling around in the UK. He probably just didn't think it was the right thing to do, or he wouldn't have known whether Mr. Sugimoto had survived. But how many years? 30 years later, he sent me instead.
He did suffer a great deal at the hands of the camp guards. And in the recording of your father, he doesn't go into a great deal of detail about his treatment. But in this one section here, he tells a story which gives you some sense of how awful it must have been.
Three people did escape. Three Dutchmen planned to take a boat. I don't know where they'd hoped to take it, but somehow or other organised it to pick up a boat. And they were caught. In fact, it was rumoured that the natives had informed on them. Well, that was a terrible time in the camp. The three Dutchmen were executed, and we were told that if there was any further attempts at escape, the roommates of the escapees would all be executed. and the whole camp would be punished. As it was, the whole camp was punished anyway, but that put an end on all thought of escape.
He didn't talk a lot about the cruelty that he'd witnessed and experienced. He tended to focus on the lessons to be learned.
How did it affect him?
I suppose it's quite difficult to say because, of course, I didn't know him before, so I don't know how much he changed, but he was a very emotional person. He certainly had his fair share of anger, and whether that degree of flaring from one emotion into another, whether that was affected, I don't know. One effect it definitely had was to make him a hoarder, and he couldn't bear to throw anything away. In the house that we lived in Cheshire, we had quite a long garden, and, well, originally there was a garage. He turned that into a shed. He filled that with stuff, and then that became full. So he built another shed in the garden. Soon that was full, and he built another shed. Having a clear out was a huge operation because he'd kept so much. He couldn't bear to part with things, and he did overeat, which again I think is probably an inevitable reaction to what was literally starvation. And so he was quite overweight.
But he did also have nightmares and flashbacks from that period of time.
He did, yes, particularly on the anniversary each year, at the end of February each year. He would tend to have nightmares then.
And did that continue for most of his life?
I think so, yes.
How did your mother cope with that?
I think it's difficult. If you know that somebody you love has been badly treated, I think it's quite difficult to accept that. I think it's probably often more difficult than when something's happened to you. I think she found his attitude over the years, you know, once I started learning Japanese and so on, I think she found it quite difficult to comprehend. She didn't mind or anything, but I think she found she was surprised that someone who'd been through such hell could then feel so reconciled to the nation as a whole that had put him through that hell. We met lots of Japanese people over the years and, you know, Mum's become as good friends with them as Dad was, really.
But the really surprising thing about all of this is that your father didn't become angry and bitter about everything that had happened.
No, he didn't. I think perhaps in the early years after the war, he might have been, I don't know. But definitely over time, he felt very strongly that the lesson to be learned was that it was important for people to understand each other, to come together, you know, for there to be friendships across nations, really. Because if ordinary people had cross-border friendships, then that would help to prevent future wars.
But I guess I'm thinking he must have watched colleagues and friends die at the hands of the Japanese. And was there not a sense of guilt about somehow not honouring their memory?
No. I remember when my father died, there were still some former Far Eastern prisoners of war who were able to come to his funeral. Of course, there were also some Japanese friends at his funeral. And in the eulogy about my father, my brother-in-law did talk about Dad's experiences and how he felt about the importance of reconciliation. And I particularly spoke to them and said, I hope you don't mind this, because I can understand that for most people, this is not how most people feel. You know, after what you've been through, what you've suffered, this is not the majority reaction. But they said they were fine with it, and they just felt they were honoured to have had 47 years of life after Japan, after being a prisoner of war. You know, this was 1992. So they felt privileged to have survived. But I didn't come across anybody feeling that he was being disloyal to anybody's memory, no.
Was he a member of the Far Eastern Prisoners of War organisation?
He was technically a member, but he didn't have a lot to do with the organisation, really. I think perhaps because, unsurprisingly, the general emotion was one of bitterness about what had happened, so he wouldn't have fitted in terribly well.
And was it that he came to forgive the Japanese for what happened, or for what they did to him?
Understand the causes and understand really what had led Japan to be in the war and the different cultural attitude towards becoming a prisoner of war. For Japanese people, of course, it was a terrible shame to become a prisoner of war. You would commit suicide rather than become a prisoner of war. In Japanese eyes, the prisoners of war would, you know, the lowest of the low. Why had they allowed themselves to be dishonoured in this way? So, yes, I think he understood what had happened. I don't know about forgive. Maybe not forgive the people who'd caused it, but to see who they were, you know, as individuals, rather than blame the whole nation.
And what was the most important thing he wanted to communicate?
Understanding and friendship, particularly cross-cultural friendship.
But you still feel you have a strong connection with Japan?
Yes, and I think perhaps because I was in Japan at an age when my ways were not set, I was still open to other influences. I think there's still a sort of Japanese influence in sometimes in the way that I behave.
Like what?
I suppose covering up my mouth when I'm laughing or smiling and trying not to be too forward, if that doesn't sound a funny way of describing it.
And it's your birthday on VJ Day.
It is, yes. Yes.
Are you going to mark it?
Yes, we always try and do something to celebrate my birthday. But it's funny that you think of it as, and you call it, as I guess most people do, VJ Day, because I never think of it as VJ Day. I think of it as the day that the war ended. VJ Day, I sort of, just sounds a little bit triumphalist, you know. We were the winners. I think we were all losers.